You want to team up? It was the best offer I'd gotten since I started my rocket-building career, but I was still a little reluctant. I didn't have much of a reputation at Big Creek, but it was still better than Quentin's. When I didn't respond to his hand, he grabbed mine and shook it, big strokes, up and down. I hastily pulled my hand away and looked around to see if anybody had noticed. I knew the football boys would accuse me of holding hands with Quentin if any one of them had seen it. I tried once more. I need to know how a rocket works. Quentin cocked his head. But that's so elementary. Newton's third law. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. I could see it was going to be necessary to be more specific with Quentin. What kind of fuel does a rocket use? The Chinese used black powder. It contains potassium nitrate, saltpeter, you know, and charcoal and sulfur. Saltpeter? Quentin sighed and then explained in some detail the chemical's properties. It was an oxidizer, which when combined with other chemicals produced heat and gas necessary to make a rocket fly. It can also kill you down there. He finished up, pointing at his crotch. What do you mean? It fixes men so they can't, you know. He straightened a crooked finger. I thought I'd better get back to rockets. Where can I buy some of this black powder? You can't buy it, as far as I know. You've got to mix it up. Saltpeter, sulfur, and charcoal, that's what we need. Can you get it? I wasn't certain, but I wasn't going to let him know it. I'll get right on it. When the bell rang and we stood up, I noticed for the first time Quentin's worn, faded shirt, thin at the elbows, and his patched cotton pants and his scuffed ankle-high shoes. Quentin wasn't a Colwood boy. He came from Bartley. He was one of the kids my mother told me to notice. The mine at Bartley was always having cutoffs and strikes, and in the last few years, many Bartley families had slid into poverty and misery. Quentin's father was probably out of a job. In 1957 southern West Virginia, you wouldn't likely starve if you didn't have money. There was always bread and commodity cheese you could get from the government, but that was about all there was. The big store was what we called the company store in Colwood. It took both United States dollars and company money, which was called scrip. The big store had just about everything anybody in Colwood needed, but would it have rocket fuel? With my cigar box of dollars and script left from my defunct newspaper delivery business, I went to Junior, the clerk at the big store's drugstore counter, to find out. Junior was a rotund little man with a cherubic face who was as smart as a whip and liked all over the town. Like everyone else in Colwood, he knew about my recent rocket disaster. Junior heard my order, cocked his head doubtfully, and said in a raspy voice, "Saltpeter? Your folks send you after that?" I answered forthrightly, "It's for me, science project. I need sulfur and charcoal, too." Junior adjusted his wire-rimmed spectacles and seemed to make a mental calculation. Then he went into the back and brought out a can each of sulfur and saltpeter and a 10-pound bag of cooking charcoal. "Now listen, rocket boy, this stuff can blow you to kingdom come. I think you know what I'm saying." I thanked him, loaded my treasures on my bike, and rode home. Beside the washing machine in the basement was a wide counter and a deep steel sink. I had decided it would be my rocket laboratory. As soon as I set my chemicals on the counter, the upstairs door opened and Mom called down. "Sonny, remember what I said. Don't blow yourself up." News in Colwood traveled a lot faster than a boy on a bike. Quentin hitchhiked over on Saturday and I introduced him to my mother. He made a short bow at the waist to her, an Errol Flynn kind of move I'm sure he had seen in the movies. Mom was impressed by it, however, her hand going to her mouth almost like a bashful girl. She rarely baked cookies, but I soon smelled their aroma drifting down from the kitchen. When she thumped down the basement steps with them and two glasses of milk, the plate she handed Quentin was piled twice as high as mine. After my mother had gone back to the kitchen, Quentin worked on his cookies for a while I waited impatiently. Finally, he took a final swig of milk, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and picked up the bag of saltpeter. He looked inside it. "Looks pure." I wondered how he would know. With the dogs, Dandy and Poteet, watching us furtively from a dark nook beside the coal furnace, we began to work. First, we mixed up several small batches of what we hoped was black powder, and as a test opened the grate and threw a spoonful of each into the coal-fired hot water heater beside the washing machine. The ingredients hissed feebly, but it was impressive enough for the dogs to beg to be let out. I opened the basement door and they bolted outside. I looked at Quentin. "What do you think?" He shrugged. Neither of us knew how rocket fuel was supposed to burn. We decided to test two of our best mixtures inside devices we hoped resembled rockets. There was some one-inch-wide aluminum tubing under the back porch that Dad had brought home from the mine to make a stand for Mom's bird feeders. I appropriated it with a clear conscience since it looked like he was never going to get around to it. I hacksawed off 2 1-foot lengths. Quentin called the lengths our casements. We hammered in a short length of broom handle at one end and then poured in our powder mixes, crimping the other end with pliers to form a constriction the Life magazine diagram called the rocket nozzle. The result was obviously crude, but it was for testing purposes only. We attached triangular cardboard fins with model airplane glue. We knew the fins would probably burn off, but they would at least give our rocket something to sit on. Quentin said, "We need to see how the powder acts under pressure. Whatever the result, we'll have a basis for modification." I was becoming used to Quentin's way of putting things. What he was saying was that we had to start somewhere, either succeed or fail, and then build on what we knew as we went along. It seemed to me, considering all the rockets that I read about blowing up down at Cape Canaveral, that was the way Wernher von Braun and the other rocket scientists did their work, too. Without Quentin, I might have been too embarrassed to fail in front of God and everybody. With him, no matter what happened, I felt scientific. Failure, after all, just added to our body of knowledge. That was Quentin's phrase, too, body of knowledge. I liked the idea that we were building one. After the fins dried, I decided we would test our creations behind my house over by the creek. I didn't think there was anything over there anybody would care about if we blew it up. To my surprise, Roy Lee appeared, claiming he just happened to be in the neighborhood. I think he'd actually been hanging around waiting for me and Quentin to come out. The first rocket emitted a boil of nasty, stinking, yellowish smoke and then fell over, the glue on its fins melted.
"Wonderful," Roy Lee muttered, holding his nose.
Quentin silently wrote the result down on a scrap of notebook paper. Body of knowledge. The second rocket blew up. A good-sized chunk of shrapnel twanged off the abandoned car we were hiding behind. A cloud of oily smoke covered us. Dad came out on the back porch yelling,
"Sonny, get over here right now!"
Obediently, we followed the smoke, reaching him as it did. He ignored Quentin and Roy Lee, his eyes on me.
"Sonny, the phone is ringing off the hook. People are complaining about the stink and the smoke. I want this stop. Do you understand?"
Mom quickly amended his meaning. "Not behind the house, dear. You need to find a better place." Dad turned on her.
"Elsie, they've got to stop trying to burn Coalwood down."
She kept her smile on us boys. "Okay, I'll make them promise. You won't burn this wonderful, beautiful city down, will you, boys?"
"No, ma'am," we chorused.
"You see?" Dad stared at her and then shook his head and went inside. She followed him, leaving us boys to contemplate what had been, after all, our scorched, stinking failures. Quentin finished his notes.
"The first sample was too weak, the second too strong. Now we know where we are. This is good. Very good."
On January 31, 1958, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, ABMA, led by Dr. von Braun, was ready to launch the Explorer 1 satellite aboard a Jupiter C rocket. It was to be a night launch, so I stayed up to watch television hoping for good news. Around 11 p.m., a bulletin interrupted the Tonight Show with an announcement that the launch had been a success. The next day, a Saturday, I gathered Roy Lee, Sherman, and Odell in my room.
"Okay, here's what we're going to do."
I laid out my plan. I was forming a rocket club to be called the Big Creek Missile Agency, BCMA, named in imitation of von Braun's ABMA organization. Quentin and I were going to be in it. We were going to learn all there was about rockets and start building them. This was to be a serious thing, not playing. If the others wanted to join us, they were welcome. I figured Roy Lee would get up and walk out rather than belong to anything with Quentin in it, but he said to count him in. Sherman and Odell readily agreed, too. I nodded. The Big Creek Missile Agency is hereby formed. I'm the president. Odell, I'd like for you to be the treasurer and in charge of supplies. Roy Lee, because you've got a car, will need for you to handle transportation. Sherman, if you take care of publicity and setting up our rocket range, I'd appreciate it. Quentin is going to be our scientist. Any questions? Sherman looked up. Where's our rocket range going to be? I had no immediate reply, but Sherman answered his own question. There's an old slack dump up behind the mine. That might do. Slack was the tailings of the mine, coal with too much rock in it. Wherever it was dumped, nothing grew. I thought Sherman had a good idea. We'll try it. Odell spoke up. So what do we do now? We build a rocket. How? Got to work on that. At lunch during the following days, Quentin and I worked on how to build a rocket, sketching out crude drawings and theorizing. We were proceeding mostly by instinct. Despite a search from top to bottom at the Welch Library, Quentin still couldn't find any books to help us. While we worked, both of us ate out of my lunch bag. He told me he usually skipped lunch because eating too much was unhealthy. I noticed, however, that his health regimen didn't keep him from eating more than half of my food. When I mentioned this to Mom, she started putting in an extra sandwich because she said, "You're a growing boy." I wasn't fooled. She might as well have written Quentin on it in big capital letters. One day, on our way to class after lunch, Quentin and I were walking past the Big Creek football trophy case just outside the principal's office when he stopped and put his hand on the glass. "Maybe one day we'll have a trophy in here, Sonny, for our rockets." "Are you kidding?" "Absolutely not. Every spring, science students present their projects for judging at the county science fair. If you win there, you go to the state and then to the nationals. Big Creek's never won anything, but I bet we could win with our rockets. And if we win with the science fair, it's got to help us get into college and on down to the Cape." Besides the fact we didn't know how to build a rocket, I told him my main objection. "Quentin, we'd just embarrass ourselves. We'd be up against Welch High School students." This was self-explanatory, I thought. Welch students came from families with fathers who were doctors, lawyers, judges, businessmen, and bankers, and their high school was the newest, best-equipped school in the county. The Welch Daily News had stories all the time about Welch students going off to college and winning honors. Although we routinely knocked the tar out of them in football, there was no way any Big Creek student was going to beat Welch students head-to-head in a science fair. Over the next few weekends, Quentin and I continued our practical work, testing different black powder mixes in the hot water heater. I was grateful when he didn't bring up the science fair idea again. Finally, our trial-and-error method resulted in a combination of ingredients that seemed to have the most flash and smoke to it. Then Quentin had the idea of putting combustible glue in the propellant so it could be shaped. "We could run a hole up through the center of it, get more surface area burning at once. That ought to give us more boost." A boost sounded good to me. I went to the big store and asked Junior if he knew of anything that was like a glue but would burn. He questioned me closely until I admitted exactly what I was trying to do. He brought out a can of powdered glue. "This is the same stuff on the back of postage stamps. Mix a little of it in your powder and add water. Let it dry. I think it'll burn. That'll be 15 cents. Once home, I got out measuring spoons, cups, a mixing bowl, and an egg beater from Mom's cupboard and carried them to the basement. I mixed up what Quentin and I had calculated to be our best black powder mix and then added the powdered glue to it, along with a little water, until I had a thick black paste. I wrote everything down that I had done in a notebook, body of knowledge. I poured the slurry in a dish and then set it underneath the water heater to dry. 2 days later, it had formed into a hard cake. In search of her missing cups, spoons, and mixing things, Mom came down, looked over my laboratory, sighed, and went down to the big store to buy replacements. She told me later she and Junior had a big laugh over it. When Quentin and I threw the black powder cake in the hot water heater on the following Saturday, it flashed vigorously. "Prodigious, old man!" he cried, using his latest big word for anything he liked. At lunch one day, I proposed to Quentin that we weld a washer or something to the bottom of the casement to be our nozzle, the opening at the rocket's bottom. Instinctively, we knew that the nozzle needed to be smaller than the casement, but how a nozzle worked and how to build one, we had no idea. Quentin agreed with my washer theory, but wondered who would weld it for us. I knew a machinist welder who worked alone up at the tipple shop during the hoot owl shift. His name was Mr. Isaac Bykovsky. Mr. Bykovsky's daughter Esther had been in my class until she was diagnosed with cerebral palsy and had to go away to a special school. My mom said Mr. and Mrs. Bykovsky were always asking about me, how I was doing in school, and so on. That night, after the hoot owl miners had descended into the mine and the evening shift dispersed, I slipped out the back door and up the tipple path. Just in case Dad was called out by the black phone, I angled away into the trees so he wouldn't see me. The tipple area was locked at night, but just inside the tree line on the mountain there was a deep drainage ditch that went underneath the fence. Nearby was also a locked gate with a seldom-used path that led to the little shop. I found the path and groped my way in the darkness until I came to the gate. I gripped the chain-link fence and edged down the mountain until I stood on the precipice of the ditch. There was a big drainage pipe there that jutted out on the other side. I gripped the links of the fence with one hand and swung down until my feet got a purchase on the pipe, then ducked underneath the fence and came up on the other side. The machine shop was no more than a dozen yards away, its lights illuminating the gate and the path. I peeked through a dirty glass pane in the back door. Mr. Bykovsky, in a baggy one-piece coverall, was working at a lathe. He was a skinny little man with tiny ears that stuck out so far it looked like his helmet was resting on them. Screwing up my courage, I opened the door and walked in. He saw me and nodded, and I waited until he finished what he was doing. "How are you, Sonny?" He sounded like it was a normal thing for me to appear before him in the middle of the night. I told Mr. Bykovsky I was building a rocket and needed a washer or something welded to the bottom of a tube. He took off his helmet and wiped the sweat off his nearly bald head with his sleeve. "I have some aluminum tubing I could use, but the welding on the washer, that's difficult. Soldering it would be easier." "That would be fine." As long as my washer was well attached, soldering sounded good to me, although I wasn't exactly certain what soldering was. He looked at me sharply. "I'm not supposed to work at this shop unless your father tells me to. Does he know you're up here?" I shook my head. "No, sir. He's against me building rockets, but Mom thinks it's okay. I need help, Mr. Bykovsky. You're my only hope." He considered me for a moment, his face grim. Then he nodded. "Come back tomorrow." The next night I again went up my secret path and found my rocket waiting for me in a cardboard box outside the gate. The solder was a perfect circle around a perfectly aligned washer at the base, and he had also soldered a metal cap to the top of the tube and glued on a wooden bullet-shaped nose cone. It was the most beautiful rocket I'd ever seen. I used electrical tape to attach cardboard fins to the casement and then borrowed Mom's fingernail polish to paint a name on the side. I named it Auk 1, after the great auk, an extinct bird that couldn't fly. I had a purpose in the name. I wanted to make it clear to the other boys that we were adding to our body of knowledge even if all this rocket did was spew on its launch pad. I loaded Auk 1 with the black powder postage stamp glue slurry mix, inserted a pencil through the nozzle, and then left the rocket sitting nose down to dry under the hot water heater. The pencil was to form a hole in the powder, increasing its surface area according to Quentin's idea. On Saturday, Quentin hitchhiked to my house, and after the other boys arrived, we inspected Auk 1. A little while later, Sherman led us up Water Tank Mountain to the old slack dump. We were at least 200 yards above the mine. I could just make out the top of the tipple above a stand of trees. Odell sat the rocket on its base and then used a rock to hold it steady. We all found hiding places behind big boulders around the clearing. Odell took a match from Roy Lee. Sherman settled in behind a rock. Odell lit the fuse and ran and fell down beside me. We grinned at one another. The fuse sizzled up inside, and Auk 1 leaped into the air in a shower of sparks. 6 feet off the slack, it made a pooting sound and then fell back in a cloud of gray smoke and landed heavily, breaking off its nose cone. There it lay until the powder quit burning. Quentin got to it first, getting down on his hands and knees and peering at the rocket's base. "The solder melted," he announced, wrinkling his nose at the sulfurous stench. When it cooled, I picked up the aluminum tube. It stunk, but it had flown. It had only gotten 6 feet off the ground, but it had flown. On Sunday night, I once more went under the fence to see Mr. Bykovsky, carrying AUK-1 with me. He examined it.
"Rockets get too hot for solder, looks like. It's going to take a weld after all, but it is a hard thing to weld aluminum. Steel would be better."
He went over to his racks of materials and selected a steel tube and cut off 14 inches of it with a hacksaw. He handed it to me, and I hefted it.
"Feels heavy." "Yes, but steel is strong, Sonny. An aluminum tube, to be as strong, requires a very thick wall. With steel, the wall of the tube can be thinner. I recommend it to you. I have been thinking also about the washer. That is not a good metal. I think we must cut off a thin piece of steel bar stock, drill a hole in it, and weld it to the base. This next one will fly, I think. I will have it ready by this Wednesday."
I decided to push my luck. "Mr. Bykovsky, could you make me two?" He made me three. On the following Saturday, AUKs 2, 3, and 4 were ready, built exactly as he had described. Once more, we went up to the clearing behind the mine. Sherman wanted to light the fuse, but I worried whether he could get away from it fast enough.
"Don't you worry about me."
He said it with such intensity that I instantly gave in. In a lot of ways, Sherman was the least handicapped person I'd ever known. He lit the fuse and ran back to a rock. Flames burst from AUK-2. It sat for a moment, spewing smoke and sparks and rocking on its fins. Then it jumped 10 feet into the air, turned and zipped into the woods behind us, ricocheting off an oak tree, rebounded back to the slack, twisted around once, twanged into the boulder Quentin and I were hiding behind, jerked 20 feet into the air, coughed once, and dropped like a dead bird. I had kept my eye on it the whole way, but Quentin had more wisely buried his face in the slack, his hands over his head. I tapped him on his shoulder, and he jerked his head up, slack spilling out of his nose. "It's down," I told him as I crawled to my feet. Odell ran to AUK-2 and began a wild little dance and song over it.
"It flew! It flew!"
"It almost killed us," Roy Lee said hoarsely as he climbed out of the ditch he'd thrown himself into.
He walked up to Odell and waited patiently until the boy had stopped gyrating. He kicked at the hot rocket.
"But it did fly, didn't it?"
We were all shaking with delight. Quentin brushed himself off and inspected AUK-2. His nose was smudged black.
"We need to come up with a better guidance system before launching again."
The rest of us weren't having any of it. Our rocket had flown. We ached to see what the next one would do. This time, Roy Lee lit the fuse and tripped, cursing. He barely made it to a boulder before the rocket blasted off, twirled around once, twanged off a maple tree, bounced off the ground near us, and then thudded into the side of the mountain above us, nearly burying itself in the dirt. While the rest of us joined Odell in another celebratory dance, Quentin dug out AUK-3.
"I'm telling you, we better not launch again until we figure out how to make these things go straight."
Roy Lee gleefully set AUK-4 up.
"We came up here to fly these rockets, and that's what we're going to do."
Without further ado, he lit the fuse. Caught unawares, the rest of us had to scramble to get behind our rocks before the fuse reached the powder. With a whoosh, AUK-4 climbed smoothly into the air and headed down the mountain. I raised a cheer that turned into a strangled yelp when I realized the rocket was heading for the mine. I had a momentary vision of our rocket falling down the shaft like a torch being dropped into a deep tank of gasoline. When I saw the smoke trail was angling off to the left of the tipple, I knew we'd escaped at least that particular disaster. Still, I had little doubt there was going to be trouble. There was no sense in all of us going after our rocket, so after a brief discussion, it was decided Quentin and I would go.
I steeled myself for what was going to happen next, hoping that maybe, just maybe, Ok-4 had fallen somewhere where we could retrieve it without being seen. We silently stole down the mountain and slipped like ambushing Indians through the open gate in the back of the tipple area where Dad's grimy little brick office was. It was Saturday, but Dad was at his office as he often was on the weekend. He saw us before we saw him. The miners had a special yell, a whoop, when they wanted to get attention in the mine, and they often used it on the surface, too. I heard Dad's whoop and looked up and saw him on his office porch with two other men. They were dressed in coats and ties. They had to be men from the Ohio steel mill that owned us, since they were the only men I ever saw wearing a coat and tie in Colwood. I spotted Ok-4 lying forlornly in the coal dust beside the railroad track. There was a big chunk out of the brick wall of Dad's office. The BCMA had rocket attacked the coal company. Dad was so mad he was huffing and puffing.
"I told you to stop this, didn't I? You could have killed somebody with that thing."
I was at least relieved to hear our rocket hadn't hit anybody. Dad came off the porch and picked the rocket up.
"This looks like company property to me. Where did you get it?"
I was too scared to reply. One of the Ohio men laughed and the other one joined in, their laughter like braying mules.
"Looks like your boy wants to be a rocket scientist, Homer."
Dad leveled a steely gaze at me.
"He doesn't know what he wants to be, but I know what he is."
He held up the rocket.
"He's a thief."
He inspected the weld at the base.
"And so is the man at this mine who helped him."
Dad ordered me to walk home. He followed about an hour later and called me out into the yard. I waited while he went down in the basement and returned with my chemicals in a cardboard box. I followed him out the back gate and then watched as he poured everything into the creek.
"This is the end of it, and this time I mean it. Collect stamps, catch frogs, keep bugs in a jar, do whatever you want, but no more rockets."
Dad also made it clear that there would be repercussions for the welder who had helped us. I sweated out the rest of the day, and then as soon as the shift change was made, slunk up to see Mr. Bykovsky. I was relieved to see him in his shop. He was working on the big steel cutting maw of a continuous mining machine. He saw me at the door and waved me inside.
Did my dad talk to you?
"Oh, your father was pretty mad. This is my last night in the machine shop. He reassigned me to the mine. I'll be operating a loader on the evening shift."
Revulsion and shame welled up inside me. I had acted stupidly, but Dad's reaction was vile and despicable.
"My dad's the meanest man in town."
Mr. Bykovsky stopped in the milling machine and came over and grabbed me by the shoulder, giving me a good shake.
"You must not say this about your father. He is a good man. I acted without his permission, and I deserve to be punished."
He released me and patted me on the side of my arm. He smiled a sad smile.
"Anyway, perhaps it is a good thing he has done. I will make more money loading coal. Look, I have something for you."
He went to the tool crib and carried out a cardboard box. Inside were four new auks, complete with wooden nose cones.
"I already made them up. They should keep you going for a while. Now go on. I have much work to do."
I clutched the box as if it were filled with gold and diamonds. "I'll never be able to thank you enough."
"You want to thank me? Make these fly. Show your dad what you and I did together."
My father had clearly, in no uncertain terms, told me to stop building rockets. The BCMA was now an outlaw organization. I don't know why, but that felt good. I had the urge to hug Mr. Bykovsky, but resisted it. Instead, I stood straight and tall and said firmly, and what I hoped was manfully,
"Yes, sir, you can count on me."
He nodded and went back to work. So did I. On the following Monday, I gathered the boys in the Big Creek Auditorium before morning classes. "We've got to get a new rocket range, someplace out of Colwood." Odell looked surprised.
"You mean we're not quitting?"
"We're outlaws now. We're not ever going to quit." Sherman was with me.
"They clear cut all the timber off Pine Knob. It's not on company property. We could go up there." Pine Knob it is.
We began our excursion up to Pine Knob the following Saturday, each of us carrying a paper bag full of pop bottles filled with different mixes of powder for testing. We had to first climb Water Tank Mountain, so-called because of the two cylindrical steel water tanks on top that held Colwood's drinking water. Once we reached the tanks, we had to go down the back side of it and then climb up a gully until we reached Pine Knob's bald top. The coal company that owned it had clear-cut the top of the mountain more than a decade ago, and the forest still hadn't recovered. There was just a sea of ugly stumps and barren, eroded dirt. After Quentin got through complaining how much his feet hurt, how tired he was, and how unscientific our testing approach was, we set up and began our tests, blowing the bottles to smithereens while we hid behind the stumps. Sherman took notes. I had ground the powder especially fine for the last bottle we detonated, and when it went off, it blew a crater a foot deep. Even Quentin was impressed. We had accomplished something nearly scientific after all. The finer the powder, the bigger the explosion. When I returned, Mom said Dad had gotten phone calls about the noise, including one from Mr. Van Dyke. Surprisingly, Dad didn't say anything to me about it. I was off company property, so perhaps he felt I had followed his orders, at least to an extent that satisfied him. But I still had a problem. Pine Knob was okay to blow up bottles, but it was impractical for a rocket range. The BCMA needed, more than anything else, a place of its own nearby where we could launch our rockets without anybody complaining. But where could we find such a place? As it would turn out, that particular decision was about to be taken out of my hands. On Sunday, Mom and Jim and I got up as usual and dressed to go to church. Dad also came down the steps, decked out in a suit and tie. Mom could not have been more astonished if he had appeared naked. It turned out Mr. Van Dyke had asked him to attend a brunch at the clubhouse after church services.
Well, la-ti-da, a brunch, aren't we fancy?
Dad frowned at her. Mom and Dad sat in the back of the church between the Van Dykes and Doc and Mrs. Lassiter. Jim sat with the football boys, all of them still grumpy about being left out of the state championship game. Actually, Dad had mollified my brother, if only a little. Jim now had exclusive use of the Buick every Saturday night. He didn't even have to wash it first if he didn't want to. I wasn't jealous of his privilege. I had only just turned 15 and didn't have a driver's license yet, and anyway, Jim had girls to take out. I didn't, and at the rate I was going, it didn't look like I ever would. I found Sherman and Odell, and we sat up front. The Reverend Lanier stood up and made his way to the pulpit. I thought something about him didn't look right. He looked a little harried. His robe seemed to be ill-fitting, and his hair needed combing. His voice was strangely nervous.
"Today I will speak on the general topic of fathers and sons."
"We live," he said to the hushed congregation, "in a day and age when fathers often do not receive the respect they should from their sons." At this remark, my antenna went up. The company paid the good reverend's salary, and was not above suggesting the topic of his sermons, mostly having to do with rendering to Caesar what was Caesar's. What sons might not be respecting their fathers? Who else but us outlaw rocket boys? Reverend Lanier told us a little story. There was once a son who did bad things, and every time he did one of them, his grieving father drove a nail in a door. When finally the son came to his senses, his father forgave him and removed each of the nails. But though the nails were gone, the holes were still there, representing the pain still abiding in the father's heart. Involuntarily, I slid down in the pew when Reverend Lanier looked directly at me. A foolish son, he told us, is the calamity of his father. I could just imagine my father smiling smugly at my mother. I thought I knew the real reason my dad was at church services. The preacher was delivering a company sermon. But the Reverend wasn't finished. He took a deep, nervous breath. This time he didn't look at me, but over my head toward the back pews. "I was taught the story of the door in Bible college, and it always stuck with me. I've used it more than once to counsel young men who've gotten a little too rambunctious. But the events of late right here in Colwood have gotten me to thinking. What of the father
who drove those nails in the door. Rather than hammering nails with anger, what if he had instead gone to his son and shown his love with his time, his interest, his generosity? Perhaps the holes in the door are a reflection of the father's petulance more than his love. After clearing his throat and tugging at his collar, the Reverend continued, his voice nearly cracking.
"We've had some trouble in Colwood lately. Father-son trouble. Of course, the son must respect his father. But I am also reminded of Proverbs 23, verse 24. He that begetteth a wise child shall have joy of him. To have a child who longs to learn is the sweetest gift of all."
The Reverend was on a roll.
"Sons, obey your fathers, but fathers, help your sons to dream. If they are confused, counsel them. If they stray, search them out and bring them home. Our Lord said, if a man has 100 sheep and one of them strays, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains to go out in search of the stray one? And if he manages to find it, I assure you that he is happier over that one than the 99 that did not stray. Fathers, I beseech you to seek out your straying sons and rescue them by keeping their dreams alive. These boys, and we all know I'm talking about our very own Rocket Boys, are dreaming great dreams. They should be helped, not stifled."
Sherman and Odell and I looked at one another and grinned. Reverend Lanier wiped the sweat off his forehead with the blousy sleeve of his robe. A moment before, he seemed to be lifted high above the congregation, carried aloft by his own rhetoric. Now, perhaps by the reaction he was receiving from certain individuals behind me, he was back on earth. In a shaky voice, he concluded,
"Of course, this is just a poor preacher's opinion. The choir will sing now."
Reverend Lanier sat down, hiding behind the pulpit, but the choir stood up and sang Faith of Our Fathers with a special enthusiasm. After the service, Mom called me over. "Why don't you wait here a minute, Sonny? I think your dad would like to talk to you." Then Dad sought me out and tossed me the keys to the Buick.
"Let's let you practice."
I was delighted at the prospect. Usually I had to beg him for days to get in a practice session. He slumped in the passenger seat.
"Go toward Frog Level."
The drive was quiet, with me carefully steering while Dad said little except to grumble when I accidentally hit a pothole. When we reached the Frog Level camp, he nodded toward the dirt road which led down through the wilderness area that was called Big Branch. I took it, and was even more careful on the rutted clay lest the big Buick lose its oil pan. 2 miles farther down the road, he told me to stop at an abandoned slack dump. He motioned for me to get out.
"Let's take a look."
We walked out on the gritty surface of the dump. Bulldozers had flattened millions of tons of coal tailings to create a black desert that stretched far down the narrow valley. No tree, not even a blade of grass, grew on it.
"If you want to fire off your rockets, here's the place. Nobody in town can see or hear you. You got the entire valley."
I gaped at the huge, flat, black space.
"How long is it?"
"About a mile, more or less."
I peered down the sun-baked dump and then at the surrounding mountains, my imagination clicking into overdrive. I could see everything as it was going to be, the blockhouse, the launch pad, and our rockets blasting off, roaring up between the steep hills, falling downrange.
"Dad, there's just one thing."
"What?"
I felt reckless.
"We need a building, a blockhouse, it's called, where we can go for protection when our rockets are launched. Could you give us some lumber to build one?"
Dad took off his gentleman's fedora and tapped it impatiently on his leg. "Company property is for company business, not for launching rockets."
But I sensed my moment. "Scrap lumber will do, and can we have some tin for the roof?" Dad plodded back to the car and then turned and pointed at me.
"If I get you this scrap, and even scrap is expensive, young man, if I do this thing, from here on I want the rocket launching business out of sight and out of mind in Colwood.
Understood?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
I looked back over my shoulder at the vast, slack dump as I followed my father back to the car. The BCMA finally had a home, Cape Colwood. I couldn't wait to tell Quentin. At the other Cape, the one in Florida, business was booming. The Air Force was launching ballistic missiles every week. Most of them blew up spectacularly, but a few wobbled downrange. On February 5, 1958, the hapless Vanguard team tried again for orbit and failed, although this time their rocket managed to at least clear the gantry before it blew up. On March 17th, they gave it another shot and this time orbited a 3.24-pound satellite nicknamed Grapefruit. Dr. von Braun launched another 31-pound Explorer into orbit on March 26. It seemed the United States was on the move. Then in May, the Soviet Union orbited Sputnik 3, weighing in at a whopping 2,925 pounds. Some Americans, the same kind who I thought would have deserted at Valley Forge, said we might just as well give up on space. Dr. von Braun wasn't giving up, not by a long shot. According to a newspaper report, he was building a huge monster rocket called the Saturn. In the spring of 1958, Congress and the Eisenhower administration set up the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in an attempt to put some order into the space program. I read where Dr. von Braun said he might leave the Army and join NASA. If he did, I knew the new agency was my ultimate goal as well. It took quite a bit of wheeling and dealing to get all of the materials we needed to build Cape Colwood, but we did it. We got concrete and poured a 5-by-5-foot slab for our launch pad. The lumber and tin that Dad left for us became our blockhouse, its shape and dimensions dictated by the lumber at hand. It had an earthen floor, a doorless entrance in the back, a flat tin roof, and for a viewing window, a wide rectangular opening covered by a clear quarter-inch thick sheet of plastic that Odell found, slightly scratched in the trash behind the big store. Beside the blockhouse, we erected a flagpole of 2-inch galvanized pipe discovered abandoned alongside a gas wellhead up Mudhole Hollow. Mr. Duncan, the company plumber, told me about it. A BCMA flag sewn and stitched by Odell's mother fluttered proudly from it. I loved the flag. It had the initials BCMA arched over an embroidered rocket with an owl, the high school mascot, riding on it. To open Cape Colwood, I loaded AUK-5 with our bottle-tested formula of finely ground black powder and dextrose cured under the water heater for 5 days. I had promised Mr. Dubonnet, who was the union leader, and the other miners at the tipple to let them know when there was going to be a launch, so Sherman posted a notice on notebook paper in big block letters on the bulletin boards at the big store and post office. Rocket launch. The Big Creek Missile Agency, BCMA, will launch a rocket this Saturday, 10 a.m. at Cape Colwood, the slack dump 2 miles south of Frog Level. True to his word, Mr. Dubonnet came to our next launch, parking his Pontiac at a wide spot on the road opposite our blockhouse. I was pleased when Jake Mosby also showed up, driving his Corvette. Jake was a young mining engineer that the Ohio Mill had sent down to Colwood to a kind of coal mining boot camp my father ran. He and I became friends, and I admired his freewheeling style and carefree attitude. Roy Lee lit the fuse to our little AUK and ran for the blockhouse. Before he got there, the fuse reached the powder, and the rocket whooshed off the pad, climbed about 50 feet, and then, as if aimed, turned and flew directly at the men lounging on the Pontiac fender. Mr. Dubonnet and Jake threw themselves to the ground while the rocket hissed overhead and then slammed into the road behind, skittering along until it plowed into a muddy ditch. It happened so quickly, I didn't have time to react. When I came up to the road, Mr. Dubonnet was inspecting the rocket with the other boys clustered around him. He sniffed at the rocket. "Your powder's putting out a lot of tailings. This is black powder, right?" "Our own special mixture," I told him. Mr. Dubonnet tapped the rocket casing and lumps of unburned propellant and ash dropped out. He smeared some in the palm of his hand. "Still wet. How long did you let it cure?" I told him 5 days. "I'd give it at least 2 weeks, sonny.
I worked explosives before the company brought in the continuous mining machines. Powder's got to be bone dry.
After Mr. Dubonnet and Jake left, we boys gathered beside the blockhouse to discuss the results of the flight. Sherman shook his head.
We've got to figure out how to make our rockets fly straight.
Roy Lee nodded.
And we've got to find a better way to set them off.
I looked at Quentin. Quentin, work on it. We'll get back together after Miner's vacation. All agreed? Roy Lee nodded again.
Hell yes. Did you see the way our rocket flew? So what if it didn't go straight? We're doing good here.
Roy Lee's got it right. We're making progress. I put out my hand, palm down.
Come on, put your hand on mine like the football team does.
One by one, Sherman, Odell, Roy Lee, and Quentin solemnly placed their hands one on top of the other, all on top of mine.
Rocket boys, I said. Rocket boys forever.
The Coalwood Mine, just like all of the mines across McDowell County in the southern part of the state, shut down for the first 2 weeks of July, so everyone was required to take their vacations at the same time. My father said it was done that way so the economic clout of the mining industry would be clear when all the miners showed up on vacation at the same time. It was for the same reason, he said, that miners were often paid entirely with $2 bills, so that local merchants would realize how important the coal companies were to their businesses. Whatever the reason, Coalwood became almost deserted during miners' vacation. One traditional miners' vacation spot was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. At Mom's insistence, that's where we went. It was the one time of the year she got Dad off to herself and out of the mountains. Days would pass at the beach without Dad saying anything about the coal mine. I noticed that Mom often reached out and just touched his hand when he was talking, and when they sat in the swing on the motel porch at night, sometimes he would even put his arm around her shoulders. They even slept in the same bed. Mom cried when we loaded up the Buick to come home. As soon as Dad drove into the backyard, we could hear the black phone ringing.
"Welcome to Coalwood," Mom muttered to his back as he ran up the porch steps to answer it.
I left three loaded rockets, AUX 6, 7, and 8, to cure in the basement while we were on vacation, and decided to fire all three the Saturday after we came back. Sherman made up some handbills to post at the big store and the post office. Since we still had a guidance problem, I spent the next couple of days in the basement tinkering with fins and how to attach them. Odell had delivered a thin aluminum sheet he'd found in the garbage, so I used some tin shears to cut some rough triangles out of it for fins. I punched holes along their inner edge with a nail, and then used steel wire to strap the fins to the sides of the casements. After I cranked the wire down with pliers, the fins, though crude, appeared to be at least attached securely. I hoped they might do. On Saturday, Roy Lee came by in his car, and I put the rockets in the front seat with us for the ride down to the Cape. We picked up Sherman on the way. Odell was waiting for us, having walked down to the Cape from Frog Level. He had already cleaned out a hornet's nest in the blockhouse and swept off the launch pad. Mr. Dubonnet didn't show this time, but Jake was there, along with a reporter from a local newspaper by the name of Basil Oglethorpe, a man who dressed in the most colorful clothing I'd ever seen. He even wore a silk scarf. We let Jake light the fuse. He ran laughing to the blockhouse, his long legs pumping. This time I had lengthened the fuse, so he had time to clamber inside with Basil and the rest of us, all hunkered down in happy anticipation. Mr. Dubonnet had been correct about letting the powder cure longer. The rocket leaped off the pad with a louder-than-ever hiss and then streaked nearly out of sight. I climbed out of the blockhouse and caught sight of the wisp of its contrail as it fell downrange. I joined the others in a stampede of joy. It was our best rocket yet. "How high did it go?" Jake asked breathlessly, as excited as if he was a rocket boy himself.
"Twice as high as the mountains," Sherman said authoritatively.
"How high was that? We didn't know." Jake had an idea. "Maybe a little trigonometry would help you figure it out. I'm a little rusty, but let me think on it." AUX 7 and 8 didn't need any trigonometry. AUX 7 did a horseshoe turn not more than 50 feet up and slammed into the ground. AUX 8 bounced once in front of the blockhouse and then exploded overhead, rattling the tin roof with steel shrapnel.
The first day back to school in 1958 also began the first day of the infamous football suspension. As a result of the attempted lawsuit by the football fathers, Big Creek High School had been placed on a year's probation. There would be no football season at Big Creek that year. Mom's warning had been accurate. Now, instead of swaggering heroically through the halls in their green and white letter jackets, Jim and the football boys trudged to class sullen and trigger-sensitive to insult. We were soon to learn that more had changed at Big Creek than the lack of football. Our teachers sat us down, shut us up, and began to talk rapidly at the blackboard, outlining the courses and what would be expected of us in the new Sputnik-inspired curriculum. Astonishing homework assignments filled our notebooks. Books began to stack up. Mimeographed handouts flew down the aisles. Clutching books and papers, we slogged from class to class, our arms wrapped around the material. The same thing was happening in high schools in every state. Sputnik was launched in the fall of 1957. In the fall of 1958, it felt to the high school students of the United States as if the country was launching us in reply. A pretty 10th grade girl approached Quentin and me in the hall between classes.
"Hi, y'all. Will you be at the dugout this Saturday? Hope so. I love to dance."
Quentin looked stunned.
"Wow, that's never happened before."
As we passed the trophy case, I saw Valentine Carmina smiling at me. Valentine, in the class ahead of me, had a figure that was usually described by boys as similar to a brick exterior convenience facility. She was standing alone, her books held to her chest. She was wearing a plaid dress and a tight black sweater, and her hair was tied back in a ponytail, an ebony, shimmering waterfall. She looked sort of doleful.
"Hi, Sonny. You want to go to the band room and neck?"
I was sure Valentine was only kidding. I came over to her and joked. "Sure, Valentine. Any day, any time." She seemed to search my eyes.
"You want to walk a girl to class?"
"You bet." Valentine leaned into me while we walked down the hall.
"Read about you in the newspaper. I'm so proud of you. Would it be okay if I and some of the other girls came over to see you launch your rockets?"
Valentine forever had the capacity to surprise me.
"I'd be proud to have you."
It was the truth. Quentin came up beside me and helped me watch Valentine to her desk.
"That is the most prodigious girl in this school."
Except for my Dorothy, I had to agree. Toward the end of the previous school year, I had been spending Sunday afternoons with Dorothy, going over math and science assignments at her invitation. I hadn't had the courage yet to ask her on a date, but I was working up to it. At the end of the day, Dorothy hailed me outside as I headed to the bus. She was a vision in a white starched blouse and navy blue skirt.
"Coming over Sunday? I need help on plane geometry."
"I'll be there."
"There's so much for us to talk about, I just can't wait."
I had to hurry to catch the bus. I waved at Dorothy from the window. She waved back and then threw me a little kiss. I felt like I was floating the whole trip back to Colwood. Jack had to remind me to get off at my bus stop. Jake had dug up his old trigonometry text and given it to Quentin and me, along with a few pointers. Sitting together in the Big Creek auditorium at lunch, we began teaching ourselves trigonometry. I had discovered that learning something, no matter how complex, wasn't hard when I had a reason to want to know it. With trig under our belt, all we would need to do was build some instruments to measure angles, and we would be able to calculate how high our rockets flew.
"Oh, Sonny, you're so smart."
Dorothy sighed on the couch in her living room when I told her how I was learning trigonometry. She leaned over and hugged me. "That's for helping poor me on this old plane geometry." It was the perfect opportunity for a patented Roy Lee kind of move. I started to slide my hand around her shoulders, but she jumped up.
"Oh, my cookies are going to burn. Be right back."
When she returned with a plate of chocolate chip cookies, she sat in the chair across from me and doled them out.
"I'm so glad we're friends," she said for about the millionth time.
I didn't let it wear me down. I was making progress with her, one little step at a time. All through the fall, I thumbed over to war every Sunday afternoon so Dorothy and I could work on plane geometry. We worked well together. As we covered each postulate and theorem, it soon became clear that Dorothy actually understood their derivations better than I did. She had a wonderful memory for details and never seemed to forget anything once she had committed it to memory. One morning, Dad plunked bread slices in the old toaster that sat on the counter and pushed the mechanism down and then went to the stove to pour coffee. When he came back, the handle on the toaster was still down, but nothing was happening. He discovered the heating element was gone, mainly because I had taken it to see if my plans for an electrical ignition system would work. Those same plans led Odell to borrow the heavy-duty battery from his dad's garbage truck. Roy Lee drove him and the battery to my house for the test. It worked, the toaster wire getting sufficiently hot to ignite black powder, but then we got distracted by American Bandstand, and then Roy Lee and Odell drove off, leaving the battery and wire in the garage. For my dad, that meant no toast. For Odell's dad the next day, that meant his garbage truck wouldn't start. There was unhappiness in both houses, and the gossip fence gleefully sang with it. It didn't take long before every missing thing in town was blamed on those rocket boys. Odell and Roy Lee confiscated some ancient mine phones from the old mule barn that once housed the mules that worked in the mine. These would become Cape Colwood's communication system. Our facility was coming together, and we were about to make a great leap forward in rocket fuel. Of all my subjects in the 11th grade, chemistry was my favorite because Miss Riley was our teacher. She was strict with us, never allowing anybody to get her off the topic even once, but she still had an impish humor which she often used to keep us alert, along with such an obvious love for her subject that we all paid attention. She was also young, attractive, and full of energy. Even though Big Creek gave Miss Riley little in the way of lab equipment to demonstrate what was in our new chemistry book, she was inventive. One day in the fall, she led us outside to the unused football field. Miss Riley poured a small amount of white powder from each of two little paper bags she had carried with her and then mixed them with a wooden spoon. This is a mixture of potassium chlorate and sugar. What we're going to see now is a demonstration of rapid oxidation. Quentin, tell us the difference between slow and rapid oxidation. Of course, Quentin knew our homework cold. When oxygen combines with an element over an extended period of time, the result is slow oxidation, rust being a good example of it. But when oxygen combines with something rapidly, energy is released in the form of light and heat. Miss Riley struck a match and dropped it onto the little pyramid of powder. Instantly, a hot, greenish flame erupted with a loud hiss. The BCMA looked at one another. We didn't have to say what we were all thinking. Rocket fuel! After class, I went up to Miss Riley's desk and pointed at the little sack of potassium chlorate. Can I have what's left over? I told her about the BCMA just in case she hadn't heard about it. We've built a range, Cape Colwood, and we're starting to get some altitude, but we need a better fuel. Have you thought any more about entering the science fair? I'm still in charge of the committee. I don't think we're ready. We're still trying to figure things out. It would help if we had a book. She cocked her head, thinking. A book? No, I can't say I've ever seen a book on how to build a rocket. I'll look around, though. Would you? That would be great. In the meantime, I pointed at the sack. She shook her head. Sorry, it's all I've got. Anyway, potassium chlorate is unstable under heat and pressure. It's too dangerous for rocket fuel. What do your parents think about the BCMA? My mother said just don't blow myself up. She laughed. She was easy to talk to. I felt at that moment like I was the most important person to her in the world. Let me agree with your mother's advice. Don't blow yourself up. I think I want to keep you in my class, okay? Okay. I mean, yes, ma'am. Quentin was waiting for me in the hall. What did she say? She won't let us have the potassium chlorate. She said it was too dangerous. He clapped me on the shoulder. That's okay. Potassium nitrate has much the same property and exactly the same number of oxygen atoms as potassium chlorate.
Mix saltpeter and sugar, and we should get the same reaction we just saw. It should be an excellent propellant. That night, I